When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
BT Sport Pods.
Hi, welcome to Michael Calvin's Football People. I'm joined by Jonathan Northcroft of the Sunday Times, and by Dominic Fifield of The Athletic. Stand by for a revealing conversation with Frank Lampard that touches on regret and renewal at Everton. That's a club with great traditions, but is that enough in the modern era? Newcastle are starting to flex their financial and political muscle in siding with the so-called top six to form an effective veto of Premier League decisions. So, Johnny, is this how a Super League breakaway starts?
It could well be, Mike. I've often thought that the most likely route to a Super League is actually within the Premier League. The European Super League was a sort of project, I suppose. It was a very grandiose thing, and we saw the sheer public fury and the political issues to circumnavigate with UEFA for the clubs. But within Britain, I think within the Premier League, it'd be a lot easier for those biggest clubs to grab money and power. And in fact, it's been happening for years under our noses. They are just chipping away every little by little at the margins of income they get compared to the other clubs. You know, there's been adjustments to the foreign TV income, the way that that's now skewed more towards the bigger clubs. And I just see that continuing. And speaking to chairman, it wouldn't seem that the failed European Super League has in any way inhibited those big clubs around the table. They're as hungry as ever for dominance, for money and power. And now we have Newcastle in the mix. Clearly that brings their number up to seven, and that puts them into that level of veto that you mentioned, Mike, because it's a 14-6 vote. And then there's odd things like, you know, Nottingham Forest saying that they want to vote with the big clubs. There's always sort of one or two little rogues that I think the big clubs feel they can buy off or pick off. I just see over the next 5 to 10 years that further chipping away at the income and of the power. And maybe what we'll get to, I mean, it was a horrible concept at the heart of the European Super League, but, you know, will we get to an idea of permanent members? Is that where we might push towards permanent members who take a greater share of everything than anyone else? And it would happen slowly, and it would happen without that kind of big public outcry that we saw with the European Super League, because sadly that's how these power grabs really occur. You know, not with a big event, but little by little.
Yeah, we'll dwell a little on the nature of the Saudi investment a little later, Dom, but I suppose off the back of Johnny's comments there, what we're talking about is a closed shop, essentially. Now, that's completely alien to our game, both, you know, well, certainly traditionally and culturally. Do you think the fans would want that? Surely jeopardy of relegation is part and parcel of English football.
I'm sure the vast majority of fans, match-going fans certainly, would rail against it. You know, there's something very intriguing about a relegation battle, unless you're in it, obviously. I mean, it does provide as much drama towards the back end of a season as the title race. So I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. It is against everything that we're that we stand for and that culturally we are used to and enjoy. Obviously, when you've got so many, for example, American owners in the Premier League who aren't used to that concept and can see the jeopardy in it quite obviously, then it's not a huge surprise that you know, there may be a move within the organisation, within the division, to go another way. I do find it fascinating, the whole Newcastle and the seventh club element, because I think when Newcastle were taken over and looked like the next money bags on the rank, the traditional established six probably initially thought, my word, we've got a real competitive rival here. And then very, very quickly, they've also recognised it as a potential ally and someone that can, as you say, warp that vote and make it into a 7-13 to ensure decisions go their way effectively. And the dynamics of that are quite interesting. I do wonder also whether the Super League concept, it's a bit soon for Newcastle at the moment. I mean, they're still developing and establishing themselves and they'll want to win, you know, conventional competitions first, I would have thought, if you see what I mean, and that they win it the old way, win the Premier League, reach the Champions League in the way that we qualify at the moment. But then further down the line, obviously, yeah, I you can see the direction of traffic.
Yeah, when we look at the Saudi investment, Yasir Al-Rumayyan, who oversees that investment for the Saudis, he's talking about already turning the original £350 million investment into something worth about £3.5 billion, which just happens to be the sort of price that Chelsea fetched. Mm-hmm. They're also spending $2.3 billion in sponsorship, mainly in the Saudi League. That gives you, Johnny, doesn't it, a really vivid idea of, one, the business principles behind this, and two, the amount of money they've got.
Yeah, I think what it does is it puts Newcastle into a context. And that context is, as you suggest, Mike, it's a program of investment and it's a program of growth. And there's a huge, huge sort of game being played here. I think what we've got to bear in mind is 2030 and the Saudi bid for a World Cup that's coming. And that might be worth $40 billion, that bid. And then you've got to wind back and look at Qatar and what they've done in the run-up to 2022, which was to get the World Cup, but then on the back end of that, to invest in the Qatari Stars League, I think is a version of the Premier League. Huge investment into clubs there with top European managers and players, Xavi Hernandez being their sort of flag bearer. Investment into the Aspire Academy. And then investment, of course, into PSG as their sort of flagship. And the acquiring of Messi and Neymar, and keeping Mbappe on a huge contract. It's all towards this kind of building towards this 2022 peak, World Cup peak, where they arrive at the World Cup with a flourishing domestic league, the richest club in the world, the biggest stars, and they've arrived at the table. And I think there's something similar going on with Saudi. Newcastle being that club vehicle, this only being the start of the investment there. And then a bit like the Qataris, also backfilling it with investment into their own domestic league. And we will certainly see the players and the managers starting to arrive there.
I was talking to a coach who's based out in Saudi at the moment, and within one of those clubs in the Saudi domestic league. And he mentioned, he stressed how everything is geared towards 2030. Mm. They're talking about the stadium, the redevelopment. They're talking about raising the quality of the league. And don't get me wrong, the quality at the moment is not good. It's a sort of mishmash of journeyman footballers who have played around the world and domestic talent. And it's not a level that it needs to be. But they're, you know, that everything is looking towards 2030. And so it's no surprise when you hear that, you know, Crown Prince Bin Salman has, you know, seen boxing bout in Jeddah with Gianni Infantino. That's the type of thing. It's all sort of moving in that direction to get that World Cup bid sorted.
You know, Newcastle have gone softly in that first year, and I suppose Bruno Guimarães is the poster boy for that type of strategy. Johnny, where do you think they go from here? Will they accelerate? You know, what will, for instance, Dan Ashworth's role be in all this?
Yeah, well, I mean, the presence of Dan Ashworth does suggest that a measured approach is going to be the way. And I think they're going to accelerate, but try and avoid the sort of crazy Chinese Super League approach of just, you know, front-ending it with two or three massive stars and nothing else. and keep doing what they're doing. And what they're doing echoes the early years of Abu Dhabi at Manchester City. There's nothing more dangerous or powerful than a lot of money spent well. And that's what they've done so far. They've worked out what tier they're at, for me, Newcastle. They've realised they're not obviously not top tier yet, but the money gets in middle tier. And what they've done is bought the very best of the middle tier talent available, I would say, and players at the right age. And the future for them's, as Man City did, just making those signings better and better and better. You know, City going from the Gareth Barrys to the Yaya Toures to the David Silvas. It just, that is now the template for success, rather than jumping in, paying $1 billion for a 34-year-old Messi and then seeing the whole thing go to ruin. And Dan Ashworth will continue that measured recruitment. They've done more in the first year than I thought they would, Newcastle. They've been very wise in their investment. It already seems a very convincing project rather than a, you know, I think we accept it already that Newcastle are a good team when they're going places. And that wasn't a given despite all the money.
Well, the next place they're going is Old Trafford on Sunday. Manchester United, you're Erik ten Hag, Dom. Would you start the player? Would you start the player? You've got more hair than him, by the way.
Largely. Nothing wrong with that.
Would you start the player that we, I suppose, we have to refer to as CR700 now?
Look, I still think it probably depends on availability and, you know, whether there are other options. Martial's absence, presumably with your injury, is a blow actually to United, because to have that the quick and, you know, fleet-footed, fluid forward line was actually serving them quite well in fixtures other than the derby. So if availability forces this hand, and it's not a bad backup to have, is it? Let's be honest, a player with 700 career goals to his name and a player that is clearly still hungry and eager and desperate to be involved at United and at first team level and high profile fixtures as well. So it's no bad thing. But I think the way that things are going with Erik ten Hag, I mean, it's in the future, you know, with the players that are available to him, I suspect he will be going a different way. I think it will be that more fluid, youthful forward line. Jadon Sancho, fleet-footed one side, Marcus Rashford, a figure like Martial through the middle, some, you know, speed and that type of quality involved rather than the Ronaldo. But my word, he's not a bad backup to have.
That's true. Yeah, you know, speaking of Rashford there, Johnny, do you detect any signs that he's on the rebound a bit?
Yeah, I that's almost top of the list of positives of the Erik ten Hag era is the rebound or the reboot of Rashford. I think the gifts, they never went away, but clearly a player who depends a lot on, I'm not sure if confidence is exactly the right word, but you could see that last season when things were difficult, Rashford was spending a lot of time within himself, if that makes sense. There was a kind of troubled, inhibited nature. I remember speaking to Wayne Rooney about this and saying, I just haven't seen him smile for a long time. You know, he knows Marcus well, and that's all back. There's an outward looking Rashford, and he's delivering with those gifts again. And I think it's a shame for him that Martial is so in and out, because one thing that United haven't managed to do in the last 5 or 6 years is develop partnerships and combinations across the pitch, because it's been such a farrago. And Martial and Rashford are always good together. They were what Louis van Gaal was building around back in the midst of time. And Martial, with his sort of maddening ebbing form and an injury record, just hasn't been reliable enough to put on the pitch the whole time. But when they play it together, my goodness, they are two players that spark off each other. And if Martial can be fit and play a run of games under Ten Hag, I think that you'll see Rashford getting better and better as well.
Well, despite Sunday's defeat by Manchester United, Frank Lampard is quietly rebuilding Everton and restoring his reputation. As he's discovered, the harshest lessons are the most valuable. So, Frank, thank you very much for joining us. Much appreciated as ever. I want to draw down on the wisdom, if you like, of a legendary NFL coach, Bill Walsh. One of his great maxims was, to succeed, you must fail. Can you relate to that?
Yeah, absolutely can. I think in all walks of life, I think it's a very general statement. But I think I felt it many a time through my career, and it's very easy to sort of brush over a career and look at the highlights. And within the good highlights, there are millions of things, hundreds of things that you can consider as failures during a playing career. So that I was very aware of it as a player. But I think as a manager and a coach, where the sole responsibility is yours for the team, you feel it's a burden. And I think how most coaches are or should be, because you have to self-analyse all the time. So you should be sort of ultra-critical of yourself and look at everything like that, which I certainly did from the start. That I realised that I failed probably every day to a degree, and certainly did in my early days in management at Derby. I walked in completely fresh and sort of not naive. That would be to overstate it. I know football, I knew football, but so many parts of football that are not things you do on the training ground as an individual player. So it's trial and error, it's failure. And one of my biggest things about management is, and people that are either really successful in it or not, or start to get on the ladder and then come off of it, is that you can never think that you've cracked it and never think that you can stop learning. So every failure is an opportunity to learn something. Sounds a bit cliche, but I think it's absolutely true.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, all coaches tend to be very, very, you know, almost obsessive self-evaluators. Mm. When you're out of the game, you know, following Chelsea, what were your thought processes? How long did it take you to get over that, the blow of being let go by a club that meant so much to you and almost re-energised you for what you're doing now?
Well, the period was probably, it was around a year. But when you're out of the job, you don't know that. So it's hard to look too far forward. So you do spend a lot of time looking backwards. And the first part, it can be quite tough. It is tough. I don't care who you are, unless you decide you're hanging up your managerial boots, you lose your job that you love doing. Maybe some people love it more than others in terms of it can be tough at different times. But it becomes an obsession. It becomes something that takes over your life. And then you take a hit in your pride, I guess, is the biggest thing. And there are so many details around that, which I won't go into because it takes so long. But you have all these different emotions about sort of regret, disappointment, anger, you know, all those sort of things. And in the first couple of months, I think they're probably by far and away the negative sides are the bigger ones that come out. And then they start to subside a little bit and you start to sort of think about positive things. And even negative things that were there in the beginning become positive, or you just become, I think with time, much more reflective. And I found it in a positive way. So things I thought straight away, I could have done, I should have done that. That went wrong, or an anger at somebody. For starters, the things I thought I didn't do so right in the first place, if I look at them now, I go, no, that were right, as I believe. And some of the things that you actually didn't see in that first moment, you see now and go, actually, that was the important thing. The biggest realisation I had, and it probably took me a few months to probably have it, of not having a job, was making sure that I absolutely focused on the future and got my own balance right across the board. First thing was family balance, because when you're working, you put it to the side a lot.
And your work-life balance goes out of kilter, doesn't it?
And it's really hard to manage. It's really, really hard to manage. But you can try harder than I was trying. I was absolutely engulfed in it at the end of my Chelsea days, and it wasn't good for me. It wouldn't have been good for my family very much. It certainly wasn't good for me to come home and be working through the night and stuff like that. You need a break. So that was the first thing that really hit me. And then the second thing was to just go over things in a much more simplistic manner and understand that football will always give you different problems that look slightly different. So it was just trying to sort of like look at things as they had been, as they were. For instance, like in the beginning, I'll look at sort of like personal relationships that, you know, with players that weren't playing and that were obviously a bit difficult in the end there, because when you're not playing internationals every week, it can become a hard one. And you start to be a little bit more balanced about the whole thing and understand that those issues might come again. How will I deal with it? Because it's easy with hindsight, and there will always be more of these in the future. So you just take the opportunity to learn. And by the time the Everton job came around nearly a year later, I was more than ready. I wasn't chomping at the bit. I was quite relaxed at home and happy, but the opportunity was too good for me to turn down, and I was ready.
Yeah, managers talk about almost like the weight of collective responsibility on them. You know, you're playing God with people's lives to a large degree. When you reflect on that, do you also look at the personal side in as much as that, you know, how much it takes out of you as a person?
Yeah, I do, and I feel that all the time, and that's why those moments to recharge are so big, because, you know, you can probably see it visually on us managers. There's no doubt. You know, you get into the job, your hair starts to go grey out or whatever it is.
There are these before and after photographs,
yeah,
aren't there?
But, you know, and that's probably the intensity of the job. But maybe that's what happens to every 40 to 50 year old as well, which is we're in the public eye and people like hone in on it. And it's a savage world at times, but that's fine. Luckily, I don't have a huge ego on that front. It's more the day-to-day, how it can affect you. And some of the biggest learnings I had were to give myself more time to out of football to really appreciate my family rather than just be present but not present. I think that was important for me and my family. And also to embrace the staff that I've got with me, make sure they're the right staff, make sure they can do things that I can't do or I'm not so good at, or they're better than me at in their own specialist part of that field, and also make sure they're positive people. Because I think the biggest drainer on life is negativity. I think it's whether, but my home life wouldn't be negative in that sense. I'm lucky, I've got a real strength there at home. But in the workplace, you're working so many hours together in so many difficult situations and going through so many failures. When I say failure, like a draw at home could be a failure, a loss when you expect to win, or even a win that performance wasn't great. That if you're negative and you first sit down in the room and everyone's like, that wasn't good enough, that wasn't good enough, that wasn't good enough, you're drained. And then you carry it around you. So you leave that office, you go into the next one, you go into the canteen, you dress the players. And negativity is dragging everyone down very quickly. I'm a big believer in a positive mindset.
Now, you're working with a specific generation of individuals. Mm. Modern leadership within football, sport, or wherever, needs to be a bit more nuanced now, doesn't it? Because of the people you're dealing with. Have you changed the way that you deal with people consciously? Because of their, you know, relative youth.
Yeah, I have. I think it's a skill, and who knows how good I am at it. I think you'd be judging that in various ways. One is in results, because the better you handle this new breed of player, probably the more success. It will be pretty directly relative to what you do, because you want to get the best out of players, so you have to be on a level with them. There's also other relationships which are the personal ones that go on outside it. So not just results, but how you enjoy, how you can improve players and people within that, because I think that's a responsibility of yours as well as a manager these days. So you really have to just sort of check yourself and try and move with the times and try and get better. It's one of the, I think, the most difficult things for ex-players to do, is more than probably the tactical side of the game, is to understand that sort of people skills side of the game.
What motivates the modern player?
Sure, because...
Because what does motivate them? Is it money? Well, you know, that's a given pretty much now,
yeah,
isn't it?
That is a given to a degree, but it's still there. I still think it's a bit relative, but it's still there. You know, if a player's earning this and their teammates earning that, it can be competition within a squad. But the days of kind of talking about, oh, they're driving flashy cars, I think are gone. If you get caught up in that, I think you're just a bit of a dinosaur that doesn't get it. I think you just have to move away from it and understand that that's there. And they'll all have different things that motivate them. It might be good old school, want to be the best player they can be for the right reasons. It might be because they want to have the biggest following on social media. It might be because of their family motivate them after. You know, typically it's an easy example, but like a Seamus Coleman would be a family man. It's clear he wants to work for himself, for his family first and foremost. But the players are changing from the Seamuses. And I think it's just the sooner you can get to try and understand what motivates them, the better. And I think they also have to feel from you a respect. And the biggest thing for me is communication. And I think that's probably always been there. But I think these younger players now in the workplace need to know why you want them to do something, to need to know how, to need to give them an input into how that's done. And so you have a bit of trial and error there, because maybe they're young boys. It's easy for me to analyse a game back and see what I think they should have done. I have to sort of sit with them and go through that and show them the wide angle and show them my feelings and ask them a question about it. And I think if you do that in the workplace and you communicate and they feel like they're engaging with you, I think you've probably cracked a lot of it in terms of the workplace. Trying to understand how they live and how they see their life is not easy. It's not easy, because I'm 44 now and I try and put myself into their shoes. What would I have done at 21? But my life and surroundings look completely different. We didn't have social media. Every situation was different. Again, you talk about failing all the time. I think you have small fouls with these things, but you try and create an environment where the players feel comfortable, where they feel like they can communicate with me and with my staff, and then you just try and get the best out of them.
Is it fair to say that you're trying to balance that generation or the habits of that generation with the values of maybe the generation that you represent, more old school? You know, I'm thinking here,
you know, someone who embodies that is a Connor Cody, that type of be the best I can be type of player, maybe James Tarkowski, people like that.
Yeah.
Was that a conscious thing that you did over the summer, that you always needed to inject that type of character into your dressing room?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I felt it from coming here. A really good group of lads in the main, but there was something for me that was missing in terms of a bit of leadership and direction. And it's not a huge criticism of the lads. They are what they are. Leaders look different in the modern day, but the ones you've mentioned there in terms of Connor and Tarky, they don't actually. They look like a bit of a throwback in terms of how they train, how they affect others around them. So I think your first statement is bang on. You know, the modern world that's moving very quickly, trying to keep hold of the things, because I think it can get lost in a young player. I think sometimes their surroundings, their friends, the agents, the this and that can talk a lot about around them outside the workplace, which is not positive. And so they, to bring them in here and for them to sense a value or behaviour or something from myself and my staff and this experienced players in the building is a big deal. And then they follow, you hope. And that's definitely been a change that we've been able to make this summer with personnel. And sometimes changing personnel is the only way.
The nature of the club, it seems to me, is unchanged. It's still, you know, the people's club line, isn't it? When you avoided relegation against Palace, that game, you know, you looked around in all that mayhem. What did you see? Did you see a spirit of a club and a community?
Yeah, I saw that then, and I saw that in the run-up to staying up, because the fans kicked into gear and, you know, did these big welcomes for us every game. It was pretty unique. I don't think I've seen that anywhere. I don't think it's happened anywhere to that level in the Premier League. So I saw it coming, and then that gave me a massive sense of responsibility to try and deliver, because the last thing I want to do is take a club down. Outside of Everton, I think it was a big talk. You know, Everton can't go down, shouldn't go down. There was no reason why we shouldn't go down in football terms. It was just up to us to fight and show that. And on that day, I saw the fans' reaction. I saw players and people who work at the club's reaction, work at the club who worked it for years. I'm not sure how many teams in the Premier League will have as many Evertonians. When I say Evertonians, I mean people that live and die at the club, working for the club. You know, Everton tattoos are everywhere here. You know, kit men, medical staff, Goodison. It is a very tight-knit club. And I understood very at that point what it meant to so many people, and I understood what it meant to my chairman and my chief executive, Denise, and Bill Kenwright. Tears in their eyes and these things. So I understood that. And then I just thought, OK, well, where do we go from here? And there's a lot of work to be done, very obvious. But the size of the club and history and the passion was never more evident for me than on that day.
Because, and I know this is sort of howling at the moon to a degree, but I will miss Goodison when it's gone.
Yeah.
Because of what that is, sure. That experience.
Yeah.
Would you miss it?
Yeah, I will miss it. So I've got two sides to this one. I will miss it. I've always appreciated to play at it as a player. Didn't like it in terms of it was hostile or difficult environment to go to, and that's what you want as a player. That's what the Premier League's about, isn't it? And then having now managed here, I feel what it means to the fans. But I also feel, and I don't know if the timing of when I've got here is that, and maybe because we were in a rut, there's no doubt, you know, there was a disconnect slightly and a direction issue, which meant where we were and we fought to stay in the league. I also think that there's a real positive thing that could be happening here, and maybe the change of the stadium's happening. I think there's a progressive side of the club. I think it's a good thing. And the most important thing then is that the club involved the fans in that process. And I believe that's what's happening. And I know it's what's happening from the hard work that's done by the incredible people here at the club, above me and around me, that are trying to show the fans that the people clubs remain, that the heart of the club remains. We're moving to a stadium that will help us progress. And can we bring the feeling of Goodison to the new stadium? And we work together, we can do that.
I noticed on social media that you brought in, when you were having your team photos, you brought in a local mental health charity.
Yeah.
One of the guys spoke to the group, which is an admirable thing, because the mental health side of football is almost the thing that people don't want to talk about.
Yeah.
Does football do enough, in your view, to look after its own?
Everton do, in my opinion, because I can't take credit for that. For the lad that came in the photo, that was an Everton foundation and the work that we do in the community, which is amazing. I've taken small parts in at the back end of last season of work they do here with men and women coming here and who have had lots of difficulties in the mental health side, and the foundation do incredible work. So I think Everton do, and that's why I think people call it the people's club. And I don't think there's any club in the Premier League. My opinion, I've not been at a million clubs, but just sensing it, I think we're right up there with the best in dealing with those things. Does the game in general do enough? Not yet. I think it's something that we're all becoming more aware of. Prince William is involved in amazing charities, and now some bigger names. It's much easier to speak about mental health issues. I'm pleased finally as well that even players who are supposed to be immune to mental health issues back in the day, you earn too much money to have a mental health issue. Mm. That old chestnut's gone away, thank goodness. And it's going to be something that we need to continue working on to give support to people, to make people very aware of what it is, and probably to understand, if we're brutally honest, that we all not suffer from it to a degree, but that it's there. Because in my years growing up, it wasn't talked about. In fact, it was just seen as a weakness. It just meant you're weak if you had any mental health issues.
When you look at the state of development of your squad, or the evolution of your squad, it's probably a statement of the obvious that the first thing was, OK, let's stay in the league, then build on from there. Where are you? And you know, when will a true Frank Lampard Everton team turn up or turn out?
Well, we're progressing for sure from where we were when we managed to stay up. There were certain things that needed to change. You've touched on them already with us, but one was a culture change. I felt that from when I came in, and I probably had to shelve some things last year because it was only on pitch success. And sometimes to deal with cultural issues and values and behaviours and a direction, they can sometimes make you hit a wall in the short term, is how I felt. You try and address things, they can sometimes you get kicked back, is my point. And I think that was one of my experiences at Chelsea, is that I tried to broach what I felt were cultural issues, which I understood from my playing days, which I understood from the time that I was away. And when I came back, I probably had ideas on that, and I got kicked back, and it was negative. And then it can sort of spill over into performance. Here, I didn't want to do that in year one. Well, year one, that 3-4 month period. When we went away in the summer and came back, I was quite strong on that with the players. We needed to change some personnel to bring in players that could reflect the changes that I wanted to make on and off the pitch. We did that. We've touched on that as well. Mm. And I think in terms of, can we be really strategic? And fortunately, came in at a time where Kevin Fairwell came in. So the connection from me to Kevin, to the chairman, to Denise and to the owner, is for me as good as it's been. People tell me that, and it feels that way. And only when you're aligned can you make those moves in the right direction, because otherwise everyone will have a different idea. And at the moment we have a similar idea of what we want to be as a club culturally and how we want. I'm really pleased with the progression we made there. On the pitch, I'm pleased, but I do know that there's a long way to go. So I don't know when I'll ever be able to answer your question when you'll see my team. I've seen glimpses of it already in the last 3 or 4 games as we speak. Performances against Liverpool, against West Ham, against Southampton, against Leeds. These performances this season. But in terms of the style I want to play and the consistency I want to play, I think we're still quite away from that, if I'm honest.
Mm. When you look at your role, there is always a moment in football where people provide instant judgment on you. Now, so you had that at Chelsea. Are you judged as a prominent former player, or you know, you can widen it to other prominent former players who've gone into management? Are you judged by different standards? Are there different emotions at play? A bit of envy, maybe?
Yeah, I would say that's human nature. And I think if you're talking about media, maybe ex-players or elements of the media, or probably maybe a cultural thing sometimes where you've played at a high level over a period of time, and maybe it's our culture here sometimes to go, OK, you better really show me you're a good coach then. You know, and maybe then you're a bit of a negative starting point. I think some English and British coaches maybe have experienced that and are experiencing that. And the difficulty with that is that you have to keep your mouth shut and your head down as much as you can and get on with it and do your job. Because to break that mould or to break that, you'll only do it by performance. The hard thing with that sometimes is perception, and nobody knows your job unless they're in it and around it with you. And that's one of the biggest learnings for me as a manager. Because I worked in the media for a year, and it was my job to sort of comment on it. Mm. And so you could easily get sucked into, I can't understand why he picked that player over that player, or why that formation over that formation. And then when you start the job and you come to a high-pressure job, and all of them are high-pressure, whether you're working in Premier League or whether you're working in Div 2, all have relative problems. You see them, you have to deal with them. and people on the outside don't. So I think it can be a bugbear, I'm guessing, of a lot of us managers, because you go, it's very easy for you to comment in hindsight after a match about that decision that I had to make, considering lots of variables that happened in the week. So there are lots of things like that. And I think it's important you sort of stay away from getting too deep in that conversation. It's important that you just keep working in the right direction. I love coaching. I was pleased that when I started managing, I wanted to be a coach, not a manager, because I felt that's the way the game was going. I thought it was going away from a manager that oversees, I felt, a situation and has coaches that do the... I felt that working on the pitch next to the players was the only way an ex-player can prove to those players that not only have you played the game at a good level, but you're there coaching it with them. Mm. I think to oversee as a manager is not easy with the modern player. They need to feel you next to them, improving them and helping them, and just get on with that. And then I think you hope that your work can take you in the right direction. So if there are any doubters, then you prove them wrong.
Yeah. There's a final question. As a player, you were known for being obsessive in your desire to achieve and reach your natural limits. Now, I'm sure that survived the transition to management. How can you be better in your new job, in your new role?
I think there's so many ways I can be, and it'll only be work and time. I talk about the squad. It's a question I get asked a lot after, and because of the way I was brought up in my career, the real positive behind my career, I know that got me there, and the building blocks of my work ethic. And so I can only improve to the level I want with that same work ethic, but directed in a different way, because it's much harder being a manager. it's not physically harder. It's mentally and consuming nature of the job, but also the elite sport and the percentages for me of success and how you get to it are so detailed and so tough that you have to work constantly to get towards them. And you look at the best out there, they've done that work and they've learned and they've continued to learn and they've repeated and then they've got something slightly wrong and they've got even better. And that's what I want to work towards. So I'm pleased that obsessive nature stayed. I think it's impossible to do this job without it. But I'm always learning. I learn from my inspiration. People ask me, who are the managers that inspired you? And as much as Jose Mourinho did, and I'll always answer that, it was 20 years ago, whatever, nearly. So for me to talk about, what an effect Jose Mourinho had on me 20 years ago is not necessarily relative to what's now. I can learn as much as I can, and this is no disrespect, I'll always say Jose, because he changed my career, but I could learn as much by listening to a podcast of a manager working in Div 1 now as I can from something that happened 20 years ago. And it might be something that I agree with, I disagree with, I think somewhere in the middle about. It just helps me a tiny bit in my job, and I love things like that. So as long as I can keep learning, I think I've got that chance.
Well, Frank, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, that was a very reflective conversation, intriguing in many ways. Johnny, you were at Finch Farm just before me interviewing Amadou Onana. Now, that's a remarkable story. But also, I thought it gave another insight into Lampard's people-based coaching.
Yeah, it was quite powerful, the testimony that I had from Onana about Frank, and it's fascinating listening to your interview with him there, Mike, and hearing how sort of, I guess, kind of reflective and balanced and human Frank is sounding these days, and probably always has been, but you can see there's a real maturity and reflection that's gone in there that's maybe softened his management as well. And speaking to Onana, who, for 21, is an incredibly impressive young man with 5 languages, told me he also wants to, he's halfway through learning Spanish and wants Portuguese, so he's got his eyes on 7 already. And then, of course, the Scouser threw into the mix. A musician, he's still studying for a Belgian educational diploma, just a really switched on and intelligent kid, and someone that's made very clear career decisions throughout his short career already, jumped from Hoffenheim's youth setup to Hamburg to Lille, and then was telling me the next step was always going to be the Premier League. And what he's always done is thought about development. And there were several clubs who wanted this guy because he's got such a range of Premier League ready skills. But he said Frank Lampard was the reason he came to Everton, that Frank was on the phone to him all summer, interested in him, not just as a player, but as a human being, outlined where he could go on the pitch. But more than that, was continually asking him what he needed, what can I do to help you? And then he said, and that hasn't stopped since I arrived. you know, I've got a relationship with him where he's checking in on me all the time. He's trying to make sure everything's right for me as a person. And he said, I've never had a manager like this. He's a great human being. And Onana, you know, he's got a life, bundle of life experiences that I think would probably give him a reasonable tools to judge the quality of a human being, because he's had some bad coaching experiences too. And he just raved about Lampard in a really genuine way. And that's before we even talked about the football. And Frank's got a very sort of appealing development plan for him as well around bringing out his attacking side and teaching him how to arrive on the edge of the box and score the way that Frank did in his own career. And I went away thinking, first of all, Everton have signed a brilliant character here in this kid. And if that's their template, then they're going in the right direction. And secondly, how important, how central Lampard is to the whole project.
Mm. What struck me was how obvious, Dom, the blow of losing his job at Chelsea was to him. Can you compare the player and the manager that you worked closely with at Chelsea with the manager who's in basically the second phase of his job now at Everton, having saved them from relegation?
Well, I think Johnny touched on it before. I think he's more mature as a manager now than he was at Chelsea. I think possibly we underestimated the toll that job had on him, probably through the weight of expectation, given his playing record at Chelsea and the fact that he came back as his returning hero at a difficult point in the club's recent history, given the FIFA transfer ban that was imposed that summer and after the real acrimony of Maurizio Sarri's tenure at the club. He was supposed to have this sort of healing effect, and to a certain extent he did. And you know, we talk about developing Onana. He developed and helped develop players like Mason Mount and Reece James, who are now mainstays of this Chelsea and England team. But I think the sheer weight of expectation for a manager that was, you know, at a fledgling stage in his career at that level really did take its toll. He seemed scarred by it all towards the end, wearing that sort of haunted look that a lot of Chelsea managers had under the previous regime. Mm-hmm. From what I saw at Everton, I mean, like, I went to the game that you talk about in the interview against Palace at the end of last season, and the sense of joy and relief within that stadium, that was evident with him as well. He really wore that. He was adored when he went to Chelsea, when he came back to Chelsea. Everybody loved him, but they loved him because they knew him. At Everton, I think there was probably, when he was appointed, a little level of suspicion there at some point. You know, how good is this guy? Is he going to be able to do a job away from his normal surroundings, in an environment that he knows so well? And, okay, they had very short-term objectives last season, just stay in the division, but he achieved that. And then I think it's testament to the impact that he's had that even when they weren't winning many games at the start of this season, or they weren't losing many, there was a sense of fun around the club and joy around the club. The supporters actually bought into what he was saying and what he was doing and the way he was acting, and the whole fact that the club had sort of remained galvanised, the fan base had remained galvanised from the end of last season. And I think that's very encouraging for Frank Lampard and shows that actually he can make this his own. He can have a success here in an area that maybe, I mean, I don't think Frank Lampard ever thought that he would thrive on Merseyside as a manager. I don't think when he set out that was what he was going to do at all. But actually, he's a bit more worldly wise now. He's taken the positives from that time at Chelsea, and he's really poured them into the job he's doing at Everton. And it's good to see. It is good to see.
Yeah, it was interesting, I thought, when he talked about, you know, he'd never seen so many Everton tattoos around the football, tattoos around a football club before.
That's exactly it, isn't it? That's Everton all over.
It is. But there's also a practical side of this, Johnny. You know, I thought his logic about, you know, attitudes to prominent players in management was spot on. Do you think it's significant that he had to prove himself on the grass as a coach to his players instead of just sort of swallowing in as this, you know, Premier League great player?
I found that enormously interesting, because actually if you look at his generation of players, there's a bit of a divide at the moment. Some of them are going down the I'm a manager route, and Frank is on the side of wanting to be on the grass as well. Gerrard, you know, bring out the whole comparison. He's the manager route. He gets other people to do his coaching. He wants to take that view. But I found it fascinating to hear he felt that unless he was there with the players doing the coaching beside them on the grass, then he couldn't have the same sort of power to demand things in terms of performance on a match day. And that's, there's an intelligence to that, I think. There's an empathy to that. A sense, I think Dom touched on it, of also feeling the need to prove himself somewhere and not rest on a reputation or laurels, but show in a new environment coaching abilities. And I just think, I think it's all part of how I think Frank really gets the job and gets the club. And that really came across in the interview too, his sort of sense of perspective on it all. I think he really gets Everton, but I think he really gets what he needs to put in for this younger generation of players to be an effective coach. And it's no surprise, he's such an intelligent guy. He's done the thinking and he's worked it out, I think.
Yeah, well, I suppose what you're referring to there is this importance that he's placing on old school values. What do you make of the balance of that team? Obviously, it's a team in transition, probably needs something more up front, Dom, but can you see signs of promise there?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's those old school values and the building a foundation that has been at the core of it. To have Tarkowski and Kolokodi in there at the centre halves, it's transformative. It just gives them a rock on which they can build, because everything about them was, there was an unpredictability about their back line previously. And that was like, you know, that was partly because of injuries and issues like that. But I think you've got something solid like that. Two players who are seasoned Premier League talents now, no nonsense, but leaders as well. People who will command respect in that dressing room and tell people if they're straying, they're not fully committed, if standards are dropping on the training ground or in the dressing room. I mean, it'll actually be Tarkowski and Cody, I would imagine, that actually go out there and tell them rather than Frank Lampard. And if you got that, those two allies in the dressing room, then it makes a massive, massive difference and probably makes your life as a head coach stroke manager much easier.
They just look like Everton again. They just look like Everton, and Cody and Tarkowski go back to a Goff and a Weir or a David Unsworth or whatever at the back. And the whole thing, that's what's so impressive about what I mean by him getting the club. Whatever Everton is, he's distilled it and put it on the pitch again.
When we look at Everton as a club, they would obviously consider themselves to be natural contributors to, say, a top eight. But we talked earlier on about, you know, the bigger clubs begin to draw up the drawbridge. Manchester City, you know, by common consent, Dom, they're going to walk the league. Look at the individual components, if we could, a bit. Phil Foden, who was saved for the last sort of 10, 12 minutes in Tuesday night's draw in Copenhagen. He needs to be incorporated into the England team, doesn't he, the starting team? And do you think his future will be in central midfield, as Kevin De Bruyne suggests?
Yeah, possibly in that kind of central midfield that... in a team that's going to have all the ball. I mean, I don't think you could plonk him in every midfield in the Premier League and expect it to work necessarily, although he's got amazing qualities in possession. I think he will be in that England team. I suspect that he will be starting. He'll probably be starting in one of the wider roles in a 3-4-3 or something like that in the forward line. He frustrated me a bit during the last international window. I sometimes, particularly with England, oh, I'm probably going to get pelters for this now, but sometimes you just want him to, he takes the extra touch maybe too often and he doesn't deliver the pass that you know he's capable of doing. And it may be because he's not surrounded by the players he's surrounded with at City, and he's on the international stage in a different team setup. But he's got all the talent to tear it up at the World Cup next month and to be very much integral to that England side. And I know Gareth Southgate obviously loves Mason Mount as well, but I think Foden will probably give you slightly more attacking edge than Mason. Mason might be slightly bit more of a worker, I'm not criticising Mason Mount in that either, because I think he's a fantastic player as well, and England are very blessed in those positions. But I'd be very surprised if Phil Foden didn't start for England. I imagine that front three will be Sterling, Kane and Foden, fitness permitting, for the first game against Iran.
Yeah. Well, Liverpool next for City, Johnny.
Jurgen Klopp already conceding the title. There's an air of hysteria around him at the moment. If we take a step back, do we have to accept the logic that no manager is unsackable?
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, we've seen enough of football, haven't we, that I don't think any manager is 100% safe. I would say Jurgen Klopp is close to unsackable, especially given his relationship with FSG and, more importantly, his relationship with the Liverpool fans. I think they're not a passive fan base, let's say. And if something bizarre was done in terms of sacking Klopp, I think there'd be more than a couple of walkouts after 20 minutes.
Well, they'd be so, over the barricades, wouldn't they?
Yeah, they'd be dismantling the new stand that's already been put up at the moment. I think he has to be unsackable as well, or close to, because he's not just built Liverpool on the pitch, but he's embodied their values. He's been their spiritual leader, as it were. He's more than a manager, Klopp. But all of that is not to sort of say that he doesn't have a huge job facing him right now, and possibly as big a challenge as he's ever had in his 7 years in charge, because he does face this phenomenon that's Manchester City and this phenomenon that's Erling Haaland, and then rivals like Arsenal and Spurs and possibly Chelsea under Potter that are actually getting better and better at a time when he needs to transition that squad and that team and has a crisis over two or three of his very best players, Trent, Salah and Van Dijk. The problems are mounting up for him, and at the same time, he's in a precarious Champions League group and he's 10th in the Premier League. I mean, it's probably never been worse for him than that right at this time. And you can see that in his press conference, lad.
Johnny mentioned there, Dom, Chelsea. What's the significance of them seeming to do business very early with Leipzig and lining up Christopher and Nkunku for next summer? Do you sense there is a plan here now being followed, and it's not as random as it might have initially appeared?
Well, I guess if you're willing to pay over the release clause in a player's contract, then it probably suggests that money's no object. Look, that may prove very true. They may be stealing a march. Well, they are stealing a march on all the competition in terms of Nkunku, getting him in early as much as they can do. There's a bit of long-term planning there. I mean, I think that's revelatory. I mean, it's not, you know, if you looked at Chelsea towards the end of last season, you know, when it was clear that there was plenty of issues with Lukaku, over the summer when Lukaku's gone and they're sort of scrabbling around for a striker and end up signing Aubameyang on what was quite a surprisingly long contract, it's very clear that they need some kind of long-term strategy in terms of their forwards. And Nkunku is one of the talented young forwards on, you know, currently playing in the Champions League. Want somebody that they feel as if they can secure. Although the last time they went and got a quick striker from RB Leipzig, it wasn't a brilliant scenario. But this is a different type of player and different skill set to Timo Werner. There is a strategy there. It shouldn't really have come as a massive surprise what happened this summer, because it was all such a rush and everything happened so late. The takeover's completion was so late, and after all their rivals had really done all their planning and made their first moves in the market, and they couldn't do that. So it ended up being a bit of a mad trolley dash to try and supplement the squad and go one way. And then obviously they realised that Thomas Tuchel isn't the man to take them forward, and they appoint a new manager. But I think behind the scenes, I think going into the next transfer window, they'll be a lot more settled, and they'll know their recruitment department will be more established, or, you know, certainly in terms of a technical director in and a sporting director to follow. If it's not secured by January, then it'll be very, very soon after that. And then the next big window, which is next summer, if you've already got the striker in, then you can start attacking things like the midfield, which you've got N'Golo Kante and Jorginho out of contract, and you can start planning ahead in that area as well. So I don't think we'll see any lack of ambition from Chelsea in the years to come. They know they've got a major, major task, a game of catch-up with Manchester City in particular, and they'll have seen what's happening at Arsenal. They'll have seen that they know that Liverpool still pose a threat. You know, they're watching what Tottenham are doing under Conte. They know they have a level of spending that will be required for them to compete for honours at the top of the Premier League, which is what they want to be doing for the first time since 2017. They want to win that Premier League title again. So there will be an element of patience there, I would have thought. what's the expression? They're getting their ducks aligned. They are sorting it behind the scenes, and eventually they will attack that market. And you know, we may see, we'll see evidence of a very, very particular strategy aimed at eroding that gap between them and the city.
Mm. This is a final question, Johnny. Very simple one. How far can Arsenal go?
They can have a brilliant, exciting run and finish second, I think. But they could, they should be looking at winning something. What a team they've got, and what a journey they're going on. They could certainly win one of those knockout competitions, and a brilliant season finishing second to Manchester City would be an incredible leap forward for that football club. I can't bring anything negative into the equation with Arsenal at the moment. They're on such a good direction. You can feel around the Emirates that it's one of the happiest stadiums, if not the happiest stadium in the country at the moment, because they're back in a real sense. And good luck to them, because it's enjoyable as a neutral to watch what they're doing, how they're playing.
Certainly is. Both Mikel Arteta, last week's guest, and Frank Lampard spoke eloquently about the challenges of managing the modern player. Now, Kylian Mbappe, to take a topical example, embodies football's excesses. He's a monster created by state sponsorship, which indulges individual ego and the cult of personality. In short, he's behaving as if he believes his brand, whatever that is bigger than his club and the game itself. It's why, in my opinion, Paris Saint-Germain will never win the Champions League. There's no substance, merely worthless wealth. There's a warning there for Newcastle. In that spirit, thanks to Frank for his time, and of course thanks to Dom and Johnny for their insights. Thanks also to you for your feedback. It's much appreciated.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.